From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to this Thursday edition of Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here, filling in for Tony Perkins today. Disney CEO Bob Iger is threatening to leave Georgia over the state's new abortion ban. The World Health Organization has removed gender identity disorder from its list of mental illnesses. And the Reverend Bashar Warda, speaking in London this week, warned that Christianity in Iraq is close to extinction. These are just some of the stories we are tracking today on Washington Watch on this Thursday. But we start today with some good news. I will kick off the show with the story about the Louisiana House of Representatives having just passed the heartbeat bill in a 79-23 vote yesterday. If a heartbeat is detected, typically around the sixth week of pregnancy, the baby is protected. Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards is prepared to sign the bill into law, and my first guest will be Louisiana Republican State Representative Valerie Hodges, who carried the bill in the House. In my second segment, the Military Religious Freedom Foundation has sued a Manchester, New Hampshire VA hospital over a Bible display at a POW/MIA memorial table. Mike Berry, First Liberty's Chief of Staff and Deputy General Counsel, will join me to discuss. At the bottom of the hour, the Washington Post published an informative fact check regarding maternal mortality rates after being misreported by mainstream media outlets. Dr. Michael New, the associate scholar at the Charlotte Lozier Institute and visiting assistant professor at Catholic University of America, will join me with his take. And at 42 past the hour, the Supreme Court chose not to hear a case on transgender school bathroom policies out of Pennsylvania. And Ken Klukowski, senior legal analyst for Breitbart News, will help me take the court's decision apart. As a reminder, go to our website, tonyperkins.com or frc.org/radio for today's podcast. Be sure to follow Tony on Twitter, at tperkins. You can follow me if you'd like, at Sarah P. Perry. And as a reminder, we are waiting on the Senate to indicate whether or not they will, in short order, take up a vote on the Equality Act. The Capitol switchboard, 202-224-3121. If you have not called your senator to express your desire that they not pass the Equality Act, we encourage you to do so. Well, my first story today is good news. Louisiana House of Representatives just passed the heartbeat bill in a 79-23 vote. And if a heartbeat is detected, typically at about 6 weeks, the baby is protected. Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards has indicated he will break with his party and sign the pro-life bill if it crosses his desk. The Senate has already approved the bill with some amendments that include language to require an ultrasound, and also clarified that abortion did not include those which are medically necessary. Joining me now to discuss this great news is Louisiana Republican State Representative Valerie Hodges. She married her childhood sweetheart, Leland, with whom she served as a missionary for 18 years in the harsh conditions in Guadalajara, Mexico. They founded an international ministry and still oversee churches in Nicaragua and Guadalajara, Mexico, in addition to her work in the Louisiana House. Representative Hodges, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to be with you today.
Louisiana would become, if Governor Edwards signs the bill, the fifth state to pass a heartbeat protection bill, joining Georgia, Kentucky, Mississippi, and Ohio. The tally came down to 68 Republicans voting in favor, but in addition, 10 Democrats and one independent also supported the pro-life measure. And Representative, I want to ask if you're surprised by that turnout.
Well, actually, I'm not surprised because we have a very pro-life legislature, and I think that's reflected in the culture of Louisiana, that Louisiana is a very pro-life state. Louisiana just has a culture of love of family, love of life, and love of God. And I think we're known across the world, really, for that culture. That's what we're famous for. So the representatives that are here are representing those people that reflect that. So I wasn't surprised. I was very, very grateful for those votes, because I know those are votes that are tough for Democrats to make. But I think the fact that our governor is pro-life and he has said that he would sign this, I think that makes it easier for them and gives them some cover. So for Republicans who stand for life, it's a no-brainer.
Well, here at FRC, we were highly impressed by Democratic State Senator John Malkovich's statement when he said, as Louisianans, we want to be about God and family first. Louisianans are pro-life. It is a strong pro-life state, and just received the prayer, support, and encouragement of people all over the great state in taking the battle to the abortion cartel and fighting for the lives of the unborn. So this goes, Representative, exactly to what you were saying, which is Louisiana is a state that has made a name for itself as being protective of the least of those. So really, it's encouraging for us to see this kind of bipartisan support, because abortion has really become sort of the galvanizing lightning rod in the political sphere, hasn't it?
It really has. And Representative Steve Scalise was here this morning, and he spoke from the House floor and just commended the debate yesterday, that he said he was just astounded at the decorum that we displayed, that, you know, as being pro-life, and then even the opposition that came forward to, and there was really no opposition to the bill except they wanted to put the exceptions in there for rape and incest, but that we can respectfully have that kind of debate and respect one another, and we don't have to demonize each other. And so that's, I'm proud of that, about our legislature. And it was pretty awesome to hear Steve Scalise say that, because he said it's something sadly lacking in Washington, D.C. So, you know, I think we see that still reflected in our congressmen who are in Washington, D.C., of the kindness that we can display even when we disagree with each other.
Well, that is something that's a perfect segue into another question I have. On the national playing field, and here in Washington, D.C., we see such a great deal of this, not only from presidential candidates, but from high-profile figures in both the House and the Senate who are Democrats. They appear adamantly opposed to any regulation that protects unborn lives. And what we're trying to figure out is why there is such an implicit partnership, such a tight nexus between Democratic politicians across the nation and the abortion industry itself. Why do you think that relationship is so hard to extract?
I don't know, except for the fact that, and I know I recently heard that somebody in the Democratic Party saying that they were going to demand that every person that's in the Democratic Party be pro-abortion. And I don't know what point that's at, but I think it's ridiculous, because there are a lot of people who are Democrat that support life and that think that the child, the baby in the womb, is a living being. And I shared that yesterday about, you know, the scientific facts of it. But to some people, the scientific facts do not matter. And I know what we're seeing is basically a culture of death across our nation. We're seeing young people constantly, you know, killing other people. And so what this bill does, it sends a message that we value life. And so, you know, people are looking, young people look at people that go before them. And so this is the culture, is what Senator Milkovich was talking about yesterday, as we push back that culture of death by protecting the unborn, the most vulnerable above us, among us, then that definitely sets a precedent to follow. And I mean, they've gone off the rail, the Democrats have, of this abortion up to 9 months. And then what we saw, the horrifying issues that New York presented, that even after the baby is born, that you could kill that baby, and they don't consider that murder. So there's definitely a disconnect in what reality is and what is fiction in their mind. And so somehow the American people, who I don't believe support that, have got to decide, do they want to elect people who represent a culture of death or not?
So I understand that this bill will only become law if the Mississippi abortion bill is also upheld in the higher court. So can you explain a little bit the mechanism at work here?
Okay, Mississippi passed the same law, and it is obviously being challenged in court, and it will go through the Fifth Circuit, probably on up to the Supreme Court. And what the trigger in this bill that we did yesterday says, so that we don't, Louisiana doesn't spend millions of dollars duplicating the same argument that Mississippi is having already and they're embroiled in, that we said that upon the passage of this through the Supreme Court, that Louisiana's law would become effective. And this is why it's so important what, you know, our president is doing in helping protect the unborn and protect not just the unborn here in Louisiana, but it would be nationwide. So it's really dependent upon what happens in the court. And so we put that trigger in there just because there's a lot of fights that we're that our attorney general is having to spend millions of dollars on already on the other pro-life legislation that we've been doing over the years that have been challenged. And, you know, laws that we passed about illegal immigration, they're defending those. So that's why we put that trigger clause in there.
So Louisiana is also considering a bill that would ask voters to add a constitutional amendment that would declare the state does not recognize a constitutional right to abortion. So in combination with the fact that this has become sort of a cause celeb down in Louisiana, that all states really are looking to Louisiana because it is not just this bill that Governor Edwards has decided that he will, has given every indication he will sign, but there is also an ancillary bill under consideration saying no constitutional right. So in combination, Representative, do you think that these measures could help overturn Roe versus Wade?
Possibly. It could if, you know, ultimately we just have to wait and see what they do. I mean, how they're going to rule on this. You know, as I said yesterday, science has brought so many new discoveries from today, from where we were when Roe v. Wade was put into place and they approved abortion, you know, on demand, basically. And so we know so much more. And that's what I said yesterday, that women really have been lied to say, this is not a baby in your stomach. This is just a blob of tissue. And you can tell whether a baby now, the science knows within 3 to 7 days, the sex of the baby. So I think as we get women that knowledge, that they can make more informed decisions, that they're seeing the truth of this. So hopefully the Supreme Court will take these things into consideration. And one of the things I did want to point out that, you know, some of the news media said, and they got it totally wrong, that my bill says up to 6 weeks. But medically, if you do an ultrasound on a woman with of that baby, you cannot detect a heartbeat until around 10 to 12 weeks. So they could have it up until then. And so I think it's a real win for Louisiana. It's a real win for the United States. And I just believe that these things are going to get through.
Representative Valerie Rogers of the Louisiana House of Representatives has been my guest. Thank you for joining us today. This is Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, an atheist group has sued a New Hampshire VA hospital over a Bible display on a memorial table. Mike Berry, First Liberty's Chief of Staff and Deputy General Counsel, joins me with his take right after this.
There is unprecedented religious persecution around the globe. In recent years, research has found increasing governmental and social hostility towards religious believers worldwide. For the last 10 years, Christians have been harassed in more countries, including the United States, than any other religious group. While the specific threats to religious freedom vary in type and intensity, one common source is the legal and cultural support for apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws, which often threaten the freedom to choose or change one's faith. In a new publication from Family Research Council, we list which nations around the world have these unjust laws on the books and spotlight people who have faced severe penalties simply for sharing or changing their faith. For more information on religious hostility due to apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws around the world, visit frc.org/ABA laws. That's frc.org/ABA laws.
When you look at what is going on in our country and culture today, do you often ask, what can I do? Well, mark your calendar for the Values Voters Summit on October 11th through 13th in Washington, D.C., and join thousands of Americans just like you who want to change the culture in a way that human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. Past speakers include President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary Mike Pompeo, Kirk Cameron, Dana Loesch, and Ben Carson. In addition, there will be opportunities to meet with organizations and attendees that share a Christian worldview, and informational sessions focused on the topics of life, religious liberty, the LGBT movement, national security, the realities of socialism, and more. On October 11th through 13th, stand with thousands of Values voters to restore our great nation. Registration is now open. Don't miss the early bird price of $99. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information. That's valuesvotersummit.org.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins today. Well, an atheist group has filed a lawsuit on May 7th against the Department of Veterans Affairs over a Bible displayed at a Manchester, New Hampshire VA facility. The group called the Bible's presence in the missing veterans and POW memorial table unconstitutional and an outrage, but the VA disagreed and said it would not be bullied into removing the Bible. The Military Religious Freedom Foundation filed the lawsuit on behalf of an unnamed New Hampshire veteran. Mikey Weinstein, founder of MRFF, said, and get this, from our perspective, it's a repugnant example of fundamentalist Christian triumphalism, exceptionalism, superiority, and domination, and it cannot stand. So he doesn't like the Bible, in other words. So joining me now is Mike Berry, Chief of Staff and the whip smart Deputy General Counsel for First Liberty, the firm representing the Northeast POW MIA Network. Mike, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be with you again.
Okay, can you tell us, first of all, a little bit about the Bible that is on the table right now? Because the Bible itself has extreme historic significance, does it not?
That's right. The Bible belongs to and was donated by a former World War II POW named Herk Streitberger. Herk Streitberger was a waste gunner on a B-24 Liberator bomber, and on his last mission was shot down and was actually captured and held as a POW in a German Nazi POW camp. He mentions in interviews that his faith was critical to helping him survive and get through that ordeal and that experience. Mm. And he became a member of the Northeast POW MIA network, and he donated his personal Bible for display on this POW MIA display.
And there's been a little bit of back and forth on this particular situation, and the Bible initially was removed, and then it actually went back, and that was when the VA press secretary, Kurt Kershaw, said that the lawsuit filed by Mikey Weinstein's group, backed by a group known for questionable practices and unsuccessful lawsuits, is nothing more than an attempt to force the VA into censoring a show of respect for America's POW community. But they still need legal help to defend their position as of right now, don't they?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the VA is exactly right to characterize the Mikey Weinstein and his organization in that way. They've got a losing track record of litigation. I look forward to seeing them continue their losing streak in court in this case. But, you know, first let me say, we represent the organization that put the display there that includes the Bible. And although it was temporarily removed, it was replaced very quickly after the VA kind of looked into, just did a quick legal review, looked at their regulations, said, oh, look, our regulations allow this type of display. They apologized, which we appreciate, and put it back. So we commend the VA for their swift response and swift action. And I want to commend them as well. I mean, Secretary Wilkie and others within the VA for taking such a strong, bold stand against Mikey Weinstein and basically saying we refuse to be bullied by this organization that stands for anything but religious liberty in the military.
So speaking of Secretary Wilkie at the Department of Veterans Affairs, you submitted a letter on behalf of your client to Secretary Wilkie, but what was the specific ask that you made of him?
You know, when I was doing the research, the legal research into the background of this case, this matter, I realized that the VA policy right now, as it stands, there is no nationwide policy or VA-wide policy that governs these types of issues, right? There is no policy that applies to the entire VA that says either you can or you cannot have a POW/MIA display.
Right.
That decision is delegated to each individual VA facility director. And I realized that basically has opened the door for this type of litigation, right, where Mikey Weinstein and activists just like him can now basically pick and choose around the country. You know, they want to sue a VA facility in, you know, Seattle, Washington. They can sue there. They want to do one in San Francisco. They can sue there. And they can kind of pick and choose in the legal arena. We call this forum shopping, right, to see if they can get the best judge they can possibly get who might be friendly to them or favorable to them or you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought, you know what? The VA secretary can put an end to all that with the stroke of a pen. All he has to do is just say, I'm changing the policy. It's now a VA-wide policy where the VA's policy officially for all VA facilities is, yes, you can have one of these. And basically, it would be a very strong and bold stand by the secretary of saying, look, Mikey Weinstein and others like you, you don't pick on my individual facility directors. You want to pick a fight, you come fight me, you know, in Washington, D.C., And we'll duke this out between us in court, you know, the National VA and the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. And I think that would be a great move for the VA. It would clarify the policy across the board. It would shut the door on this kind of piecemeal litigation where, you know, in one jurisdiction you might have a court that says, oh, nope, you can't have a POW display that includes the Bible. And in another court you have one that says, yes, you can. You know, and our veterans deserve so much better than that, especially any veteran who spent time as a POW or was missing in action. I mean, they're the ones that really suffer as a result.
So we have about 2 minutes left here. Give us the Cliff's Notes versions of why the Bibles on these display tables are not an Establishment Clause violation.
Well, I mean, first of all, they're historic, right? They go back decades, and they've traditionally been part of the POW/MIA display. They symbolize the strength gained through faith that gives those captured or missing the strength necessary to survive. Also, as I mentioned, the VA is not the one that puts the Bible there. It's a private organization. Our clients are a private organization. And so the VA simply says, look, if you want to put up a display, as long as it's consistent with the VA mission, we'll allow you to do it. So the MRSF is barking up the wrong tree here. Their issue is with us and our clients, but they're too cowardly to come after us. They have to pick on the VA.
Mike Berry, who is Chief of Staff and Deputy General Counsel for First Liberty Institute, has been my guest today. Always a great conversation with him. We will be watching closely, and we are hoping that Secretary Wilkie does issue a uniform policy. You are listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, we have a fascinating story. The Washington Post actually caught a factual error and published an informative fact check regarding maternal mortality rates. Dr. Michael New, the associate scholar at the Charlotte Lozier Institute and visiting assistant professor at Catholic University of America, will be my next guest after this.
Grandpa Jerry, what are you doing?
What? What does it look like I'm doing? I'm sitting on this bench enjoying my tea and reading the news.
You always tell me that I need to stand firm for faith, family, and freedom. Why aren't you standing?
Well, now with this new Stand Firm app, I can sit and stand at the same time. And if you got the Stand Firm app, you could learn something besides that garbage of peddling in public schools. You could listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, where Tony and leaders on the Hill and other culture influencers weigh in on current events. You can read FRC's latest publications and articles responding to what's going on in the news, like this.
Oh.
You can play trivia and earn points for free prizes. You can even access all of FRC's publications directly to sharpen your mind and give you the ability to discern the thoughts and intentions of the heart.
I can be a mind reader?
Kid, that's from the Bible, the richest piece of literature on God's green earth.
Can I see this stand-up? Wow, this would keep me informed. Visit frc.org/app to download FRC's Stand Firm app.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins today. On Tuesday, the Washington Post published an informative fact check regarding maternal mortality rates in Texas. Well, this opened up a bit of a can of worms as to a claim that's been oft repeated by Planned Parenthood leadership. And at a House Ways and Means Committee hearing on May 16th, Democratic Congressman Don Beyer of Virginia claimed that the reported rate of maternal deaths in Texas doubled after funding cuts to Planned Parenthood. Unfortunately, as the Washington Post pointed out, Congressman Beyer was relying on incorrect data. That's the opening paragraph of a new column at CNS News written by my next guest. Dr. Michael New is the associate scholar at Charlotte Lozier Institute and visiting assistant professor at Catholic University of America. Dr. New, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk first of all about the 2016 study, and that was really the origin for this discussion here. How did that incorrect data give rise to sort of a cascade of data after it?
Sure. In 2016, the academic journal Obstetrics and Gynecology published a study looking at trends in maternal mortality rates, and they found there was a large increase in the maternal mortality rate in Texas. And a couple of things were interesting about this. First, they were very guarded about their findings. They found the maternal mortality rate had doubled in a short period of time, and they even were somewhat skeptical of this. They said outside of war or severe economic crises, we don't really expect maternal mortality rates to double. The other thing that was interesting was if you look at the data closely, they found the maternal mortality rate started to increase around 2010. This was before funding cuts took place at Planned Parenthood. The Texas State Legislature removed Planned Parenthood from the family planning program in 2011, and those cuts probably really did not take effect until 2012. That said, the mainstream media has really been looking very hard for any evidence of a public health crisis in Texas ever since the legislature cut off funding to Planned Parenthood, and they ran with this. And there was a steady stream of articles claiming that these cuts in funding to Planned Parenthood caused this big spike in maternal mortality in Texas. And I had commentary saying that the numbers don't add up, that the authors were guarded, but the mainstream media and Planned Parenthood and their allies just ran with the story.
So to his credit, Congressman Don Beyer from Virginia immediately recognized the error in the data, admitted to it, but there were other parties who were relying on the same data. So, for example, the American Medical Association, how did they respond when this was made clear?
Yeah, they wanted the record corrected, that obviously this got a lot of attention and there was a task force to look more closely at these findings. Obviously, if there's high rates of maternal mortality, that's an important public health issue that should be taken seriously. And a task force of public health professionals was assembled that looked at actually each maternal death that was found in the original 2016 study. And they found actually less than half these deaths really should count under maternal mortality, that they involved someone who was either pregnant or had just given birth. So they really looked at each individual death and looked at the cause of death. They found that the actual maternal mortality rate in Texas was actually half of what was reported previously. Mm. And this study came out, again, same journal, Obstetrics and Gynecology, in 2018. And it was good to see public health professionals come out and correct the record. Unfortunately, the mainstream media did cover it, but they only gave this a fraction of the coverage of the previous study. So there's still a lot of misinformation out there about maternal mortality rates in Texas, and this congressman gave incorrect information. And to his credit, he admitted the mistake. His spokesman said it was an honest error. The American Medical Association wanted his testimony corrected. So lots of people acted admirably, including the Washington Post fact checker. But it's just frustrating for pro-lifers. One thing I often joke with my colleagues at the Loesch Institute, we're like playing the whack-a-mole game every day. that these misstatements keep coming up, and you know, for all the op-eds we write and all the radio shows we do, we just can't seem to really penetrate the mainstream media. But hopefully this fact check will help.
Well, and in fact, it's very interesting because you discussed the fact that Glenn Kessler, who was the reporter for the Washington Post, said, listen, the abortion industry is not doing itself any favors when it doesn't just own up to the fact that this data is incorrect. And you and I find ourselves really at the precipice of this huge national dialogue, a wave of state litigation, all related to these particular pro-life issues, and yet we have been saying all along there is not a thousands of deaths correlations in what the studies have shown, has there?
Right. I mean, the Washington Post actually did another good fact check recently on kind of abortion-related deaths prior to Roe v. Wade. And there's actually data from this on the CDC, from the CDC. And contrary to what abortion rights proponents say, including Lena Wen, who is the now president of Planned Parenthood, there weren't thousands. The CDC found there were 39 abortion-related deaths in 1972, the year before Roe v. Wade. Even someone like Stanley Henshaw, who has worked for the Guttmacher Institute, which up until 2007 was Planned Parenthood's research arm, he puts the number of deaths at about, say, 300 in the 1960s. Now, there was a decline in abortion-related deaths, but it wasn't due to Roe v. Wade. I mean, most public health experts agree that it was antibiotics, it was penicillin, it was improved medical practices. The legalization of abortion, you know, really did not have much of an effect on this.
So we really find ourselves at this sort of interesting juncture, and this is why your reporting, Glenn Kessler's reporting, repetition of what we know to be the facts, and in fact pro-lifers said we have been saying this forever, are so important to distribute, to publicize, to continue with our mission, the important cause of defending those who cannot speak for themselves, because we are up against the animus and the weight of misinformation. Dr. Michael New has been my guest today at the Charlotte Loesch Institute. You are listening to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, the Supreme Court chose not to hear a case on transgender school bathroom policy coming out of Pennsylvania. Many people are worried for what that portends about American jurisprudence. But Ken Klukowski joins me next to discuss.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate. not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
The latest Trojan horse on Capitol Hill is called the Equality Act. The way the left is advertising this bill is misleading because it does not further equality at all. It would actually violate current protections in place that allow private institutions and people of faith to freely act in accordance to their deeply held beliefs. The Equality Act explicitly removes religious liberty protections that were originally put in place with bipartisan support. Its stated goal is equality, but its actual result is harm to vast members of communities, individuals, and Americans as a whole by undercutting our foundational freedom of religion. Is this really what equality looks like? A more fitting name for the Equality Act would be the Inequality Act. For more information on the mass threat of the Equality Act, visit frc.org/EqualityAct2019. That's frc.org/EqualityAct2019.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here, filling in for Tony Perkins on this Thursday edition. As a reminder, go to TonyPerkins.com for today's podcast and for more resources and information about today's guests. You can also find us at frc.org/radio. Be sure to follow Tony on Twitter at T Perkins, or follow me if you'd like at Sarah P. Perry for musings on policy, among other things. As a reminder, the Senate will soon be considering the Equality Act that passed overwhelmingly in the House. It is Nancy Pelosi's crown jewel, as it were, and we have yet to determine whether a vote will be immediately forthcoming in the Senate. So, to that end, call the Capitol switchboard, 202-225-3121. Again, that's 202-225-3121. Call your senator. Let them know you want them to vote no on the Equality Act. Well, we know the Supreme Court's docket is crammed for this next season, but one particular case that the Supreme Court declined to issue cert for was a case that some of us were surprised they wouldn't snatch. Politico.com reported that the Supreme Court declined to hear a case challenging a Pennsylvania school district bathroom policy allowing transgender students to use the bathrooms of their own choice, Doe versus Boyerton Area School District. The conservative law firm Alliance Defending Freedom represented a group of students in the case, alleging that the school district's policy violated student privacy. And ADF has actually represented students and school districts in similar lawsuits across the country. The Supreme Court's decision leaves in place a Third Circuit Court of Appeals unanimous ruling last year that the school district in Pennsylvania can continue allowing transgender students to use bathrooms that align with their gender identity. The court later revised its ruling, toning down the language that said federal law protected that right. Joining me to provide his expert analysis is Ken Klukowski, senior legal analyst for Breitbart News. Ken, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks so much for having me, Sarah.
So there are so many angles on this decision of the Supreme Court not to grant cert in the Boyerton case. But I want to start with this. Michael Levin, counsel for the school district, said that the court's recognition that the case wasn't worthy of further review made it appear and clear that it understood the false narrative being peddled by the plaintiffs, that privacy rights were being violated. The Boyerton Area School District provides private bathrooms and locker rooms to all students who do not feel comfortable sharing such spaces with others, transgender or cisgender. So, does this mean their determination not to grant cert mean that they recognize the case isn't worthy of further review and consider this a false narrative?
No, Sarah. The school district's attorney is making himself look very foolish in making such an ill-informed statement. Anyone who knows anything about U.S. Supreme Court litigation knows that it's black-letter law. The Supreme Court's made it clear many times in writing that a denial of cert, a denial of review, is in no regards a reflection on the merits of the case. The court is offered 7,000 cases a year. They only take 80. That's about 1%. And I think there's two perfectly good explanations as to why the court did not take up this issue at this time. And it has nothing to do with agreeing with this school district's policy or with their asserted legal argument.
And in keeping with that notion, the counsel for the school district was backed up by the ACLU, who represents Aiden DiStefano. This is a student in the Pennsylvania school district who is transgender, meaning this is a biological girl who identifies as a boy. We need to make that clear. They represent the Pennsylvania Youth Congress, a coalition of LGBTQ youth leaders, and the ACLU tweeted, much like Michael Levin, this is a victory for trans students and educators. But ADF had a different take. They said that the Supreme Court should have reviewed the case and that students struggling with their beliefs about gender need compassionate support, but sound reasons based on common sense have always existed to separate male and female teenagers in private spaces. So is that your view as well, Ken?
Actually, no, Sarah. I have a third perspective on it. I think there's two possible reasons the court did not take it. First of all, the court has taken for the fall, and I think they are very right to take, one of ADF's transgender cases, this one, the RG and GR funeral home case, which is whether the term sex in Title VII, forbidding employers to engage in sex discrimination, whether the term sex includes gender identity. There's also a parallel case, Altitude Express v. Zarda, which the court is also hearing, which will determine whether sex includes sexual orientation. So the whole LGBT agenda, or at least the part to do with SOGI measures, sexual orientation and gender identity, the court will be deciding that in the fall. In doing so, what was being asserted here, and conservatives, there are good people on both sides in the conservative camp of what I'm about to say. What the plaintiffs in the Boyertown case were claiming was a brand new constitutional right not to be in a state of partial or total undress in front of members of the opposite biological sex. Now, they base that on what's called substantive due process. That is the same doctrine that lays at the foundation of a right to abortion in Roe v. Wade, a right to same-sex marriage in Obergefell v. Hodges. Conservatives have always said that substantive due process is a fundamentally unfounded doctrine, that it's not found in the text, structure, or history of the Constitution. And the reality is that the word transgender doesn't show up, but neither does the idea of a generalized concept of privacy, or abortion for that matter, show up in the Constitution. So now, let me make it clear, I think from a policy standpoint, these transgender policies are, I think, if I was a parent in that school, I would have a huge problem with the idea of putting a 17-year-old boy student in the same shower right next in the same shower room right next to a 15-year-old girl after a sporting event. The question is, under the U.S. Constitution and in the American system of government, who gets to decide? Should those outraged parents get together and demand that their school board change the policy? If the school board is lousy, should they vote them out of office, or should they go to their state legislature and demand that they pass a statewide law that supersedes the school district? Or do you go to an unelected federal judge to have him say that the federal constitution, which nowhere mentions this issue on either side, somehow has a constitutional right that not only overcomes this local policy, but that also from that point on, no one's allowed to vote on it because now it's part of the U.S. Constitution, which right. means no one can pass any laws about this, including pro-family laws. So while now there are some conservatives who say, look, you know, fight fire with fire. If they do it when it comes to issues like abortion and same-sex marriage, we should be able to do it when it's advancing a pro-family goal. So there are people with sincere motivations who believe that. But there are plenty of conservatives who say, we think these policies are outrageous, but the way you fix them is through the democratic process, not opening the doors for what those conservatives would consider judicial activism, just judicial activism that is serving a conservative agenda instead right. of a liberal agenda.
Right. So we understand now RG plus NGR, funeral home case, Altitude Express case. These are two cases that are going to be taken up in the fall on two LGBT issues, and in particular and relevant
well,
to what I've mentioned.
ADF will win. And let me emphasize that. I am convinced that ADF will win in those cases.
Good. So tell us why. Tell us why.
Oh, just because we're talking about Title VII, that's an act passed by Congress, the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I think the evidence is overwhelming that in 1964, Congress, when it wrote sex, meant biological sex, that it was not referring to sexual orientation, was not referring to gender identity. And the left knows this. This is why they've tried passing ENDA every Congress, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. They've been trying to do that to add these SOGI measures to Title VII because they've admitted for years they wouldn't be trying to pass the law if they thought it was already in there. It's only after ENDA has failed every 2 years in Congress that they've just switched strategies and said, you know what, we don't even need a law. Of course, they're still trying to push it through Congress. That is
right.
telling.
But with the Equality Act.
It's already there. It's already there. We don't need to worry about it. That's right. And so now, by the way, if the court is willing to go the extra mile that Boyerton was asking for it to do, if that is the explanation, it's perfectly understandable that the court would start with the baby step of settling this statutory issue in the funeral home case and in the Zarda case and just lay that as a foundation to then tackle this broader constitutional question. But I have to say, there's a lot of originalists and textualists, serious legal minds on the conservative side, that felt very nervous about inviting federal judges to start inventing new constitutional rights, just constitutional rights when they happen to support a conservative policy agenda.
So it's no wonder then several students, when they sued the school, they claimed a constitutional right to refuse to be seen naked. And we've talked about this a little bit, sort of construing a right where none existed, but on which the court has in the past made a particular determination for or against. And lawyers also argued that the trans policy violated Title IX in federal right. education law. And this will be an issue to which we will come one way or the other, either through the courts or through the Senate when and if the Equality Act, which we hope does not happen, actually passes the Senate by some miracle. But again, 20 defectors puts us in a completely different situation than we would ordinarily find ourselves in. So the court in the federal district, the first trial court here, what did the judge say about reasonableness?
Well, and this is truly outrageous. In fact, both the district court and the Third Circuit Appeals Court, their decisions were shockingly wrong. In the case of the federal trial judge, the district court, he said that it was unreasonable to even object, for these plaintiffs to even object to having this biological girl with them, because they said a person's sex, a person's gender, is whatever they identify to be, not only in the eyes of the law, but it should be that way in the eyes of their fellow classmates. So once this girl declared herself a boy, all the boys in the school should have regarded her as a boy, and so should not have objected to her being in the locker room or the toilet area with them, because if they were sufficiently enlightened, they would understand that this is actually a boy. And so it's still an all-boys environment right now in the locker room, and you're just being unreasonable by failing to see that.
Which, to me, I find stymieing that this was edict that came from the mouth of federal elected or federal jurists who have extensive experience in interpretations of the law, as is their judicial charge. So reasonableness as to whether or not you accept someone's gender identity becomes suddenly the hallmark of this. So in our last...
Wrong if you don't share a belief in transgenderism. Not only are you wrong, you're not even a reasonable human being.
So in the couple of minutes that we have left, because really there's so much to this, but I want to give the listeners who are here with us today hope, because many of us, those who have not sort of delved into the deeper issues as you have so expertly, see their refusal to grant cert as essentially a holding of the door for the Pennsylvania School District and a permission for these transgender bathroom policies. Should conservatives not lose hope? Is there good news conceivably on the horizon?
There is. They should not lose hope, because the law is actually on their side. And the biggest immediate fix is, now I believe this issue will ultimately, the biggest immediate fix is to mobilize, to make this an election issue. Because the average American, I am convinced this is still a center-right country. And if the voters say, I do not want my 15-year-old high school freshman girl, daughter, to be sharing a shower next to a 17 or even 18-year-old junior or senior high school boy, I think if voters articulate their objection that way, to say, I am the father of a 15-year-old girl, I do not want her standing naked next to a naked 17-year-old boy. I don't care if he calls himself a girl or not. I don't want my daughter in that environment. I think elected officials will find it irresistible that they have to respond to that level of outrage as we get into these basic issues of personal dignity and privacy. Just because it may not be a federal constitutional right that the Supreme Court is willing to recognize does not mean it is not a right that parents can demand that local or state leaders adopt policies to protect.
Ken, we could go on much longer, but unfortunately, the clock tells me otherwise. Ken Klukowski, who is the senior legal analyst for Breitbart, has been my excellent guest today. Thanks for joining us. This has been Washington Watch, the Thursday edition. I have been sitting in for Tony Perkins. This is Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships. Go to TonyPerkins.com for more information on today's show. Follow Tony on Twitter at TPerkins or me at Sarah P. Perry. And we'll talk to you next time on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.